CliffCentral.com.
It is just about 8 o'clock, and we're going to check in with a new show that we're starting soon with Carly De Villiers and with Ntombi Ntombi, and we'll find out all about the show that they've got planned for us. South Africa's first and only wedding show on the internet. This is going to be terrific. It's called Wedding Central, and we're going to meet both of them in a second. I think this is probably the only time I could play this without being sarcastic. You know, sometimes we play wedding music, and it's usually when there's a story about a wedding that's gone horribly right or horribly wrong. And here this morning we get to play it as the actual intro music for a new show. A big business. Welcome, ladies. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Ntombi, thank you, Carly. Very nice to see both of you.
Thank you.
And by the way, you're looking terrific this morning, which is always
nice. Yeah? Early.
Way better than us who wake up at 4. Yeah. Sorry, there we go, Mavs.
No, that was what I wanted to say immediately off the bat is, oh my gosh, they look gorgeous.
They do.
Well,
look,
and Ntombi is a makeup artist as well, so we kind of, we did an early morning start together.
Well, listen, let's cut to the chase here on this thing. Weddings are massive, massive business in South Africa. I think gazillions get spent every year by couples who are getting married. Mm. The venue, we were talking about it earlier when I mentioned that you guys are coming in. The venue, the flowers, the makeup, the dress, the food, the before parties, the after parties, the music, it's endless. Mm-hmm. And it's the one thing that no girl and most guys don't want to have turn out badly, so they throw money at it.
Yes.
It's huge, right?
It's massive. It's also, people stay for it, do you know what I mean? And there's so many parties contributing in this day and age. It's big monies. 1, 2, 3, 400, R500,000 on one day, one 24-hour session that people are spending money on.
What is the cheapest wedding you've come across, and what's the most expensive wedding? Just give us an idea of range.
I don't. You know what? I do it per person attending, so I don't have like a full-on budget. But per person attending, the cheapest one that I've done is about 1,650 rand per guest attending.
Yo, okay, so that's the cheapest. Let me just figure this out.
Okay, I had about a 40,000 rand budget.
But how many people?
Let's say
it was only 8.
Yeah.
Shame. I really helped this lady. But
how many people?
It was 100 people, and it was 40,000. But and it was very cheap.
All right. So hang on. I'm trying to get an idea of scale here before you give your example. So Ntombi did one for 1,650 a person.
Right.
So if they had 100 people, it would still have cost them 165,000.
Yeah, and that's not even an extravagant wedding. That's like
That's what you said.
Yeah, that's basic. That's people eating. That's people sitting at a table.
Does that include the dress and the hair and the makeup and
all,
the photography?
All inclusive. In. But literally, it's basics, guys. Yeah. Like bare minimum.
And the most expensive in Ntombi?
Most expensive I've done is
8,000 rand a head.
Yeah.
Okay, so if we had that same 100 people...
Oh, we're getting close to the million mark here.
800,000.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you know it's never 100
And that
people.
Was for 100 people. That wedding was specifically for 100 people. So it wasn't like it was a...
I had an 8 million rand budget.
Though. Where are we finding money?
You had an 8 million rand budget?
Oh, yeah. 20 people, but it was a vow renewal, eh?
A vow renewal.
Yeah.
It's not even a wedding.
It was a vow renewal. A lot of people are spending money on vow renewals. Yeah. So I don't know if it's...
And they gave you 8 million rand and said, we want to do this extravagant vow renewal.
Yeah.
Yes.
What did you do? Did you launch them into space?
You know, they had everything under the sun when it came to food. There was a lot of wastage, I must be honest. They accommodated all their guests as well. They transported them. There was helicopters. There was dancers and singers. It was...
How old were this couple renewing their vows?
They were about 40.
Sure. And they got married how much earlier than that?
It was about 18. It was an 18-year vow renewal.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's something else, huh?
Yeah. So we are finding vow renewals are becoming quite trendy as well. So
that's
it's quite
phenomenal.
Interesting.
Okay. These are big numbers that you're throwing around here. How is the average South African affording their wedding? Are they getting into debt over their wedding, or do most people just save up for it and then they're okay?
Look, I've had a lot of instances where I've met with clients and I've said to them...
And the banker actually at the door of the... the banker
have
there to
the
say,
meeting at
I'm
the bank.
So sorry, but we're not going to allow this to go ahead. Yeah.
But I've met with clients and we've spoken about costs, and I think people don't realize how much weddings actually cost. And I've said to clients, you know, honestly, you're not going to get something good. And I've had clients go away for a year and a half, 2 years, and come back and say, "Don't be, we've got the money. Let's now do the wedding." Yeah. People
would rather save, yeah, as opposed to going to debt.
That's clever.
They would rather
save. We advise that as well. You don't want to start your life off in debt.
Yeah, imagine.
It's one day.
It's one day. That's what I never understand. So you spend, let's say it's R1 million on one day. Yep. And it's beautiful and everything's fantastic. Yep. And you have photographs to prove it. And it's the most wonderful thing. And it leads to a marriage that's, I don't know, 10 years.
Forever.
10 years.
Forever. Okay. We're selling fairy tales here forever.
Let's be generous. 15 years. Right.
But yeah, having said that, we're knocking in terms of how much people spend. But if you go into the corporate environment when it comes to events,
right,
that's where there's big money.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of what we've also got to remember, it sounds like a lot of money out of somebody's individual pocket. But come corporates. From a flower and decor perspective, I could probably get away with charging 3 times more for a corporate as opposed to a wedding.
Yeah.
Sure. So people will say, you know, weddings are a fortune and it's a big money, but you're dealing with a person's individual pocket as opposed to a corporate budget. So, don't knock too much.
Yeah, because saying to somebody that R100,000 is not a lot of money is not fair, because it is a lot of money. It's just for a wedding. It's not really a lot of money. So
I just want to talk about you a little bit, Ntombi.
Yeah.
Ntombi is the owner of the Extravaganza Group, which consists of Extravaganza Wedding Planning, Extravaganza Express Decor, Bridal Makeup, and the Black Wedding DJ.
Yes.
Nice. Been in the wedding industry for almost 7 years. Mm-hmm. What got you into this?
I've always been one for events. So even at school, I was always part of, you know, matric dance committee, all of those kinds of things. So events have always been my thing. But for me, weddings, there's just a bigger payoff. Like on the actual day, there's nothing better than seeing the bride and the groom happy and in love and whatever. And that for me is where it ends. I don't see the marriage. I don't see what happens afterwards. For me,
they could go home and hate each other.
Yeah, for me, I end at the fairy tale. So for me, it's all about that. After that, no, I'm not so involved. So for me, that for me was more gratifying. And I've done corporates. I've worked at one of the big banks, and corporates just aren't for me. There's nothing there. There's nothing fulfilling there. But weddings, definitely hard work, the hardest job I've ever had in my life, but definitely a bigger payoff.
And how did you meet Connie?
I met her at the SA School of Weddings. She was doing a function at one of the venues that I was working at, and I was the venue coordinator there, so we were talking, and she's like, "Oh, I've just started the school," and I was like, "Oh, weddings, I really want to get into it," and I went to the SA School of Weddings, and that's how we met.
Tell me about the SA School of Weddings.
This is so interesting. I never knew such a thing existed.
So many people see the SA School of Weddings, and they'll say, "Do you train people how to get married?" No, you know what it is we deal with a very practical... Thanks, Gareth.
Just plays. When you walk into the SA School of Weddings, just plays.
When you slip into one of their elevators, right. This is the elevator.
We have an elevator now. I like that. It's actually a big factory, basically.
That's actually the best.
Okay.
Can we get that at the office today?
Yeah, we'll put it in the reception. The SA School of Weddings came about because at the end of the day, people need, it's a practical environment that we work in. So we have to train people how to make the cakes and the stationery and the flowers. And, you know, where do you learn that? You can't learn that in a book. No. And there was always, there's been correspondence courses and theoretical courses.
And let's be fair, most girls have kind of made it up. They've had to call in their moms or their sisters or their aunts or whoever.
Have done it before.
Right.
And we have people from all walks of life. At the moment in Cape Town, we've got a lady that's an advocate. Mm-hmm. She wants to do weddings.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is it a course that you provide?
We have different courses. So we do flowers. You can do a flower course, or you could do a dedicated wedding cake course, or wedding planning, or stationery. So it's anything within the wedding industry, but it's all hands-on and practical. So they're physically making the cake and the flowers and doing the stationery.
Yeah. The issue is that people have no idea how much work it is to plan a wedding. Mm. And also, if you're spending that much money, you want to make sure that you're spending it in the right place. You know, you're actually pulling that
because
money.
Because you really don't want to feel like you've wasted money.
Yeah. How many weddings have we been to where, you know, you see that there's a lot of budget being spent, but then you're like, no man, still
they're not utilizing
missing.
It to the full potential.
And Carly, you've been in this 14 years.
Yes.
aren't you tired of weddings?
Do I have to answer that?
Do you sometimes?
I absolutely love weddings.
Let me ask you. Yeah, I'm going to ask both of you this, and I want you to be as honest as you can. When you see a certain couple, are you able to tell fairly quickly whether this is going to end up being, first of all, a good wedding?
Absolutely.
And second of all, if it's going to be a decent marriage or not.
Yes, you can tell it straight
away.
Yes,
you can tell.
Really?
What do you look for?
Yeah. I actually think I should have studied a bit of psychology as well, because you do end up being a little bit of the psychologist in the background. So but you can.
What do you look for?
I think a demanding bride is your first telltale sign of how that marriage is going to go.
Otherwise known as a bridezilla. But also
we don't have bridezillas in Tumbi.
There's no such thing. Right?
No.
No such thing. For me, how I tell is the communication. There's, you know, when you're sitting at your first meeting and your first consult with the client and, you know, she's taking over and she's like, oh, this is what we're going to do, or this is what I'm going to do and my wedding and that kind of talk. And there's nothing that they've discussed together. And, the groom's like, no, that's not what we spoke about. And those kinds of things will quite easily tell you that, I don't know.
And what about a situation where there's an overbearing mother-in-law who takes over?
You've seen some of those, right?
Do you know some suppliers don't even allow the mother-in-laws into
meetings? It's true.
Some put it on their websites that they will not have mother-in-laws. They only deal with the people getting married.
Yeah, I've had to print a contract at a venue and just show the mother-in-law and say, listen, you're not my client. Would love to, but
a lot of the mothers are living their weddings through their kids, and that's quite a challenge because, and also from a supplier's perspective, you've got to listen to both aspects, and then who's paying as well. So it's so difficult to actually manage that sometimes. But you've always got to look at what the couple are looking for.
And what about those instances where the groom has zero interest and he would rather the bride just take over? And
he's just all about
I actually don't care, just have her do everything.
He just wants
the
party and the sex afterwards.
yeah, he's there for the good time. But I mean, that's changing, hey?
They're getting
a lot
more
involved. In the last 2-3 years, the grooms are at every meeting. They have a say. The colors aren't so front and center. There's not flowers. They are part of the planning process. It's not like back in the day when it was like, give me a time and place and I'll be there.
Because you see, the couples are paying together. So, it's got, and a lot of the money's coming from the groom's side. Mm. So he wants a say.
Is there any secret book of wedding do's and don'ts? Because I've always thought a wedding should not be a buffet. It should be seated, sit down dinner.
He's got very fixed ideas on clothes.
Have you been to a wedding where it's plated and you're still hungry?
I am not the age where I go to weddings yet.
Really? You'll go through the cycle.
You'll be sick of them soon. I've been to some amazing weddings, and I've been to one or two that were, to be fair, very few of them end up being horrible because you're usually around people that you know, and it's more the company than anything else, right? But during the course of all your experience in weddings and everything that you've done, have you figured out what it is that little girls, when they are first able to imagine, they start imagining their wedding day? And some of these things are realistic expectations, and you can make their dreams come true, and then it's really, for them, extraordinary. But sometimes they have an idea that just isn't practical or possible. What kinds of outrageous things have you been asked to organize for weddings?
I had a bride getting ready at the venue. Chapel was at the venue. Everything was on site. And then she said to me, yeah, but I want a helicopter. And I said, but where are you going?
I just up and down.
Let me know. And she was just like, no, but I said, no, my doll, there's just no way. I said, let's do it for the engagement shoot or something else. And she's like, no, but she wants people to see her. And stuff. I was like, but everything is on site. Literally the room, she didn't even need a golf cart. You could literally walk there.
I've had an owl fly the rings down the aisle. And I'm sure you know the owls in a black culture is very much don't do that. People did have a slight.
Is there a trained owl that can do this stuff?
Yeah, she wanted shame, and she's ended up being a very good friend of mine, so she's probably listening. she wanted an eagle originally.
Oh Jesus!
And we had literally tried every avenue to try and find a trained eagle to fly these rings down the aisle, and I ended up finding one in Cape Town. Yeah. And we had arranged for transportation and everything. She was getting married here in Joburg. Mm-hmm. And a month before the wedding, the bird died.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you kind of can't tell the bride, like, you know, your eagle's dead. But, you know, but you always make a plan before you tell the bride what the situation is. So I found it a spotted eagle owl, and it worked out fantastically. But I sat
and
at the back.
And did it all go well?
Yeah, but I sat at the back of the chapel. I was at the back, standing outside, and an owl breathes very heavy. So the people at the back of the chapel were actually like, this poor planner is like really out of breath, you know, because they could hear this breathing something at the back. And then all of a sudden, then they understood why I was breathing,
you know,
so loudly.
I would never have known that an owl breathes heavily otherwise, like if you hadn't come in this morning to share that.
Yeah, can you imagine that? It's like, I really wanted an owl, but you know, heavy breathers.
Amazing.
And we had Rottweilers walk down the aisle, and I had poop scoops waiting in the sidelines in case. And
you
then
have
if
to
he cocked
think
his leg.
Of everything.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And all he did the whole way through the ceremony was growl at the priest.
Oh my word. Yeah, I had a bride come in on an elephant as well, and it was a black wedding. And
An elephant.
And you know, black people, obviously, when they see the bride, they ululate. You can't ululate around an elephant.
No.
Bad idea. So literally, we spent like half an hour briefing the... I said, please, please, people, understand what... there will be death if you ululate. Please. Look, I was so afraid, because even during the rehearsal... Oh my... I was just like, you know what? Please, people, listen to what this man is saying. And I made sure that it was a white guy giving instructions. Please, guys.
Yeah.
This is not my brother.
Try explaining to the 76-year-old Gogo that she can't ululate
exactly.
at the wedding.
You know, I sat Gogo, next please. To her. I was just like, please, Gogo, like, this is not... No, it's not that kind of party.
You wanted to ask something, Bashida.
I wanted to ask something, because my husband and I, we're still planning our wedding. We're already married, but we're saving up to have our big white wedding.
Right.
We have ideas. He's very involved. He's a creative, so he's got a lot of creative ideas. So I'm very creative, but I'm trying to pull back, because he's got a lot of creative ideas himself.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, if we get the venue, everything will come together. But he's thinking, no, we must get your dress first.
Does he want to see the dress?
I don't know.
Well, you need to ask him this.
I need to ask him this. Because he wants to have a beach wedding. And I'm like, let's get a venue first. Then we'll take care of the dress.
So I went to a beach wedding once. It's kind of a little...
it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, you get the sand.
Oh, it's my worst case.
And if the wind blows, it's a disaster.
Sometimes
you know?
I would rather not.
No.
Nope.
What's the most complicated venue you've had to deal
beach.
With?
Beach. Anything, and Cape Town as well, because you've got...
Just generally Cape Town.
Generally. But, I mean, Cape Town's got some amazing venues, but it's just the weather factor is quite a mission.
And what's the most magnificent-looking venue in South Africa, in your opinion? Like, if you had an unlimited budget and I said to you, look, I just want the most beautiful place in South Africa to have this wedding.
Oh,
and you're obviously giving one place an extraordinary spotlight here, but you can say two or three if you have more than one.
I think Tinswalo is a beautiful venue in Cape Town. It's beautiful. Here in Johannesburg.
Johannesburg.
We've got so many different...
We've got one or two nice mine dumps, don't we?
See, we predominantly deal with Johannesburg.
Can we have a mine dump with a couple of braziers and some old Ford Cortinas?
Just throw a tent in there. We'll be fine.
And tell me, where have you worked? That's your...
I think Joburg lacks in stunning, stunning venues.
Yeah.
I think we need to put a lot of work in to get to the wow factor.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time you have to paint the picture for the client to be, oh, we're going to add this and add this. But White Light is gorgeous.
White Light is a gorgeous venue.
It's beautiful. It's new, 2 years old now?
Yeah.
Where is that?
It's out in Nanseria.
Everything's out there, right?
Yeah, it's like wedding capital out there.
Oh.
So yeah, I think that's pretty gorgeous, and it's small.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think that's a top runner.
Yeah, I mean there is amazing venues in Johannesburg. We struggle with the fact that the venues dictate what the style of the wedding is.
Mm.
Mm. Whereas Cape Town is very much a blank canvas, and you can pretty much do what you want, bring in your own caterers. So for that sense, I enjoy the Cape Town weddings, but Johannesburg we're very much stuck in this is what Cape Town or Joburg has to offer.
I've heard some horror stories about some of the things that go wrong at weddings, and I wonder how involved you guys get. I went to a wedding where the groom was found passed out on the bathroom floor by the end of the night.
I try to forget about
it. Do you guys get involved in that at all, or do you leave it up to the family and say, handle your business?
There's only so much we can get involved in.
He drank himself into a blackout state, this guy. Passed out on the bathroom floor.
He was trying to escape that wedding.
I wonder how long they stayed married.
I've had a situation where it's at there's two venues at one wedding. Two weddings at one wedding venue, and the bride and both brides knew each other, and they both lived in the same area.
Oh,
so they competed against each other. They had the same. The bride knew that this cake was coming from this supplier. The other bride went with the same a bigger cake, but then on the day of the wedding, the guests knew about this competing wedding. Mm-hmm. They went and trashed one of the bridal suites. But it ended up being the guests from that bride's wedding ended up trashing their own bride's bridal suite. It was like Bridal Wars 101.
Yeah.
So
I've had families fight at the end of the night. There was this family you could see from the get-go. It was quite a small wedding, but you could see from the get-go there was no talking. Like cocktail hour was the quietest I've ever seen, and there was alcohol and people were not talking.
Alcohol is your biggest problem.
Yeah, and then you know someone said something in one of the speeches and like gone down, best man down, and then it was just
they started hitting each other.
Yeah, no, it was a fist fight. Dresses were torn. Like the bride and the groom went home in separate cars. It was a mess.
Oh my God, it
was a mess. But stuff like that, you can't really help. Like that's your fam, bro. Like if the food is late or the decor, or like there, I'm in. But I mean, your family.
Don't be. That's why all these shows about weddings people love so much.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, you want to watch a really beautiful wedding, and you want to see everything go beautifully, but you actually deep down want to see a total disaster.
Exactly.
Because then you go, well, mine was better than that.
And a lot of the reality shows don't show that. They show the pretty side of things. So that's why with this show, we're going to bring the good, bad, and the ugly.
I can't wait. This is going to be amazing.
And in terms of, I just want to thank Wedding Expo, because they've sponsored our show. And
excellent.
I mean, it is the first one like it of its kind, and we're really, really grateful for them to be sponsoring our show.
Well, this is going to be a one-stop shop basically for anyone who is interested in, who wants to know about, who's curious about, who wants to be entertained by and has some kind of intrigue or interest in weddings. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you're not, this discussion is probably my favorite one this week so far, because there's so much we can talk about with this. I had a friend. We have a group of friends on WhatsApp. Who doesn't these days? and I thought that this guy was pretty cool. Like he was, you know, confident and happy and had his shit together. And on the occasion of a wedding of another member of the group, which he wasn't at, someone put up the comment, "Oh, wow, guys, thanks to the couple who got married the night before. Thanks for an amazing wedding. Hashtag best wedding ever."
Oh.
This guy left the group in a temper.
Oh my God.
Because his wasn't the best wedding.
This is
an adult, sensible human being. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah.
This is how seriously people take this stuff.
And that's where we also have to deal with it day in and day out. One bride is trying to outdo the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have quite a few brides will come back to, or friends will come and
we're
do the wedding.
Do it again.
I am getting to that stage after all these years, but let's not go there. But we'll have friends come to us to do their decor and their styling, and they want to do one step better than what their friends had, because remember
brides who take pictures at the weddings they're at, and then bring them to you and go, okay, we must be bigger than this, better than
exactly.
that.
I've had brides come to me with the exact picture that she's been at a wedding and say, "I want her wedding." And I'm like, but you're friends, why would you want the same wedding?
Really?
Yeah. And we said, no, we're not prepared to do that. We'll do something similar, but please, I'm not copy and pasting the same wedding over and over.
Something happens to women, like they are rational
before
all their lives.
And
then they get engaged, and I don't know.
And Toby, have you changed it? Because you're engaged.
No. I hope not. You let me know.
I will let you know.
Congrats, you're engaged.
Thank you. Not engaged, married traditionally. But it's something, there's a switch or a wire that goes loose or something, and like they lose all, I don't know, right? Like, it's hard. I don't know what happens, but for the next 18 months, it's like, yeesh.
This is so great.
Yeah.
I am very excited about this show. It's going to be Wedding Central here on cliffcentral.com with Ntombi Nhlapo and Kali de Villiers. It's going to be amazing.
Fabulous. And we'll also be at the Wedding Expo in Cape Town this weekend.
Oh, excellent. People can come and say hello.
At the CTICC. Mm-hmm. You know, and we've also got a competition running. So they can come and take a selfie with the...
What's the competition?
So what we're going to do is you've got to come and take a selfie with the Cliff Central selfie station. Mm-hmm. And you've got a hashtag of Wedding Central and...
Cliffcentral.com.
Yeah, right.
We've got to get used to this, okay. Garrett.
Right. Don't worry.
And you could stand a chance of winning a bouquet and a decor styling consult from the SA School of Weddings. Amazing. And then also there's another one for an engaged couple coming to who would like to be at the Wedding Expo this weekend. We've got two tickets. So for now, if you've been listening and you are in Cape Town, please hashtag cliffcentral.com and Wedding Central, and you could stand a chance to win two tickets to the Wedding Expo this weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Yes, and at the station, Carly's going to be asking all the brides about how they got engaged and short interviews. So please come by and
that'll
give
be
us.
Part of our next podcast. We want to know interesting stories about your engagement.
I'm going to be awesome.
I'm very curious to know how much do bouquets cost? Because I thought you just ordered from the florist.
Oh really?
No. I told you he doesn't know much about weddings.
You haven't been through the cycle yet. obvious, yeah.
Listen, some of these couples, some of the brides, they want a certain color of flower that doesn't grow except in the nighttime in Burma.
And you have to import it and
but
cut it and treat it.
Throwing it and giving it to somebody else.
No, these days we do too, hey? There's one that they keep, and then there's like a smaller, cheaper one that they sell.
So how much am I looking at?
I kid you not.
There's a smaller, cheaper one you throw.
Yes, you know
to those other, to those other bitches, they're not married yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Have you seen the petals, size of those bouquets? You'll knock them out if you're going to give them throw the real one, you know?
Wow, flowers, huh? That's an expensive business.
Yeah, you know what? We're dealing with a market where the whole of Africa is buying our flowers on our auction in Johannesburg. So, like, Angola, the whole of Angola, their flowers are coming from here, and they're dealing. They've got dollars, so we're now playing with the exchange rate.
Ooh.
So that's why we're spending so much. South that's
African,
why flowers.
So
are
South African girls, get ready for a couple of blades of kikuyu grass. It's going to be your bouquet.
Think out the box.
Beautiful. Yeah. Like some cosmos from the side of the road.
We've done silly things like that. I had to pick up leaves once. She wanted to throw dried leaves. And then one day I had to go to a park. And this poor old woman said to me, "Are you doing community service?" I'm like, "No, actually, I'm just picking up leaves for throwing petals at a wedding."
I've seen leaves. I've seen confetti, obviously. I've seen glitter. I've seen...
Real glitter?
That's a mess.
I think so. Like, I don't know, like big big pieces of glitter.
Oh, big. Okay,
then,
cool.
Then I've seen butterflies.
Have you done?
Yeah,
they're
releasing
a
butterfly.
Do they live?
No, they hardly ever make it.
Because they freeze them before they release them.
Yeah. And you have to thaw them out, and some of them just
and it's a mission, because you've got to freeze them and defrost them in time.
Oh, that's a mess. Yeah.
What else?
For confetti.
Dried leaves, you said?
Petals. We've had popcorn. Fruit Loops. But you've also got to make sure the popcorn and the Fruit Loops are fresh, because people still, they want to eat them.
Yeah.
Why would you want to throw Fruit Loops at your each other? I don't know, but...
Fruit Loops. Wow. All right.
There's all sorts. It's going to be a fun show.
This is going to be one hell of a show. All right. Don't miss it. We'll give you all the information on cliffcentral.com. If you want to find out how to enter those competitions, it'll be up there as well. Thank you very much, Kali. Thank you, Dominic.
Thanks so much
Thank
for having
you
us.
So much
we
for
will
having
see
us.
You guys
Very excited.
Soon. Okay. There we go. Let's, here's your new theme music. Get on with it. We've got things to do, people to see, places to go. Kali and Dombi will be on with Wedding Central soon. First episode to air shortly. We'll let you in on all the details. What you see is no surprise. All right. I mentioned earlier that there are a couple of very, very interesting stories that are starting to emerge. And sometimes it takes many years after something has happened for a story to come out. This is one of those. Ben was talking about, what was it, Monument Men? Is that the show that you used to talk about?
Yeah.
Right. So that was a movie about kind of stolen Nazi art. And I didn't know that here in South Africa we'd have some kind of link to that.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, you know, this is how many years later now? 60, 70 years later almost. And there's a great book called Dagar Dust, which has just come out. And it's the story, really, of a guy called Carney Mattison who looked into his family's history, right?
Yeah, hi, Gareth.
How are you? Now, you're not Carney. You're Charles Salier. You're the co-author.
Yeah, I'm the young guy that wasn't around when all of this was kind of kicking off.
It's quite something.
And, you know, I heard about this guy, and he's 70 now.
Yeah.
And I met him when he was 65. And, you know, I was hanging out with some guys who were trying to make movies. You know, they were doing documentaries. I was working at FHM at the time.
Right.
And these guys said, you know, we found this guy and he's spent like 30, 40 years trying to recover this art that was stolen from his great uncle in Norway.
They were in Norway, yeah.
In 1941. So this guy was friends with some of the greatest painters of the time, you know, mostly impressionists. And it's people like Edgar Degas, Lautrec, Manet, and Matisse.
These are some incredibly valuable paintings. And these impressionists are probably the guys who fetch the biggest price tags at Sotheby's and Christie's.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take that first exhibition they had, I mean, when they were nobodies.
Toulouse-Lautrec, this is some serious money.
It is. Of course, he doesn't like to really look at it in terms of money. For him,
I'm looking at it in terms of money.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But, you know, he didn't do it to make money out of it, because he hasn't sold a single one of these paintings, and he never will. And I doubt that his children will someday either. Sure. And they don't have documentation. I think that's the really fascinating thing about it, is that he never received a single certifying document for any of these paintings. But he did track down the Nazi that he believed is the guy that pulled the trigger in 1941.
All right, so let's go all the way back to the 1940s. Norway was invaded. It was right near the beginning. It was before
1940, yeah.
Before the French had succumbed, or yeah, it was. It was just before the French and Holland had gone down and all the rest of it. Norway was an important key point for Hitler.
Yeah, he needed it for Sweden's iron ore, and they were trying to build
Norwegian
an atomic
oil.
Bomb.
Right.
They were trying to build an atomic bomb, and Norway had heavy water.
Correct.
Which they needed.
Deuterium.
Indeed.
So, this guy's family, Carney's family. What kind of people were they? What were they doing? Were they very wealthy people? I mean, you'd imagine with all of this art.
So this great uncle of his was possibly the most mysterious member of their family, yeah. You know, because he was just kind of doing his own thing there. And a lot of the pogroms of the time had spread the family far and wide, which is the reason why Carney was born here in Joburg. And, you know, the book looks into all of that interesting diaspora mm-hmm. of the Jewish people in the late 1800s, and how they got to Pretoria, and how they became in many ways part of the early Afrikaners as mm-hmm. the Smos, mm-hmm. you know, and many of them still kept their Jewish identity, but a lot of the Yiddish went out. By the time Carney's dad was a theater man, you know, a lot of that brilliant Yiddish dramatism that he loved so much just wasn't finding an audience anymore.
Yeah.
So this family member was known and spoken of, and there were these notes and these letters, but people didn't really speak too openly about it because it was very traumatic. And so he had to kind of piece it together, and he spent so much of his life, and he looks back in it now and he thinks he wishes that his parents were alive, especially his father, because his father knew a lot more about what happened to his great uncle, whose name was Cornelissen.
Now, this great uncle Cornelissen, he was shot by the Nazis, right?
Yeah, he was shot in the head after being kicked out of his house down the stairs.
And this was the house where all these artworks were.
So, yes. I mean, this guy was quite old at this time. And he had this friendship with Edgar Degas early in his life before.
So he actually knew him?
No, he knew most of these. I mean, that's what makes many of these paintings so special, is that
they were personal gifts.
I mean, he was an international business lawyer. And it's very interesting how Carney kind of modeled his own life on his idea of who this great uncle was. Because Carney became
a lawyer much the same. You know, he also does international business law, mercantile law, and he has a PhD now in law, and he's a high court lawyer.
And he's a pilot. And
he's,
kinds a, of other
he's
things.
An aviator. He can fly helicopters.
Right.
And he started Supper Theatre in South Africa. He's
fantastic.
He's a big entrepreneur. He owns businesses here in South Africa and elsewhere in America and so mm-hmm. on. So,
an interesting family.
It's a very interesting family in many ways, I would say, a dysfunctional family, and a lot of that comes from his childhood, where his parents were very troubled, and none of that is held back in the book, you know. And I would say his mother was quite abusive towards him, and that made him the person that he is, because he just decided at a very young age that, you know what, I'm just going to look after myself. And he bought himself a tiny little box caravan,
right?
And he had a little power lead from the house to the caravan, and he froze his butt off in winter, and just taught himself how to play the violin. And he was in a philharmonic orchestra in his teens already. And, you know, went up to this cave up there in Oostkloof, because they lived what is now Northcliff, was more or less peri-urban farmland plots back in those days for poor people. Now it's like the abode of CEOs and captains of industry.
It was huge houses up there.
Absolutely. You know, the best views in Joburg. But back then, it was more or less just the land of the vultures, you know, and he would go up there and hang out with the vultures and play his violin in this cave. And it was there where he kind of decided that, you know what, I can do whatever I want. Because he looked down and he saw these tiny little cars moving at night along this little road. And he said, you know, all of those people have tiny problems. And he said he felt a bit like Gulliver looking down at the Lilliputians. And it was this transcendent moment for him in his life where he said, you know what, I'm never going to let any problem be bigger than me. And ultimately, I'm actually insignificant. So it doesn't really matter what I do. I should just do what I feel like doing, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. So for him to take on a task like this to try to find these paintings, I mean, people said to him, you know what, that's kind of impossible, man. I mean,
like, never win.
Where are you going to do it?
You're never going to get anything back. It's going to be a waste of money and time. And
he agreed with him. He said, yeah, sure, I know it's impossible. But whenever the opportunity came along, you know, he would try. And, you know, he wrote to almost every art dealer that he could in Europe. He went to, I think the families that he made contact with here in Joburg, a lot of it was driven by this quest for the art. And I think that's what contributed to him becoming successful, because he started moving in these circles of people who were into art. And that kind of shaped him into the person he is now, because, you know, he was meeting some of the richest people in South Africa. You know, he became this bank manager, and back in those days, being a bank manager made you somebody very special.
Mm.
Nowadays, it's nothing much. You know, back then, you could really make big decisions, and people could make that call to their bank manager, and that was a big deal.
Right.
Nowadays, nobody says that anymore. Nobody says, hey, I'm going to phone my bank manager. Like,
no.
What? But back then, you know, that's the kind of world that he was inhabiting, and it opened up opportunities for him. And so, you know, when he just did all these crazy things, like, suddenly I'm a lawyer, but I'm going to go off and learn to be a helicopter pilot. I'm going to go and fly with the SA Air Force at Drakensberg, Dragon Peaks Air Force Base, and learn to be this super, like, airwolf pilot.
Yeah.
You know, and he was able to do these hectic maneuvers down the side of mountains and in gusting winds. And, you know, he was approached by the government, and they said, you know what, we need to bust sanctions. Because, you know, the world hates us.
Right.
And he was saying, well, you know, I'm a Jewish guy. I mean, I hate apartheid.
Yeah.
And then they said, yeah, but you're going to work with Mossad. And he said, okay, I'm in, because they can maybe help me to find these paintings. So he had all these adventures.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, he had all these adventures that he wouldn't have had if he hadn't said, I want to find those paintings. And so because he started working with Mossad, and he more or less became a kind of part-time spy while being a lawyer and all these other things, and flying people across the border and flying goods and things across the border to bust sanctions, that's how they helped him ultimately. It took years and years and years. But they put him in touch with someone.
It's a treasure hunt.
It's a treasure hunt.
But, I mean, the story of this family and everything else, notwithstanding the treasure hunt, would have been fascinating enough. So it gives you an excuse to tell these amazing stories.
Indeed.
And Connie must have been an incredible person to work with on this book, because you must have discovered new things every time you spoke to him.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, I just originally wanted a story for my magazine that I was working for, and we got a nice lead story, 6 pages, you know, and I thought my work here is done. But what I based that on was a self-published book that he had done. And reading that, there were so many unanswered questions.
Yeah.
You know, and I said to him, Connie, you know, you've got an amazing story, but what's really going on here? You haven't really told it in the right order, and there's a lot of intrigue, but I don't really understand who you are and what the motivation was. So I told him, you know what, if I can find a South African publisher for you, then let's tell your story again. Let's write the book from scratch again. And he agreed to do that. But he's not somebody that really likes the attention. You know, he wrote that original book more for his children, mm-hmm. so that they would kind of have an idea of who he was, because they always used to say to him, you know, Dad, you're kind of a weirdo. Like, what, how did you do all these things, and what are you about? So he wrote that book. So I had to kind of twist his arm and say, you know what, Connie, come on. You know, South Africa deserves to hear the story, because we didn't even know that we had a kind of Nazi hunter.
So how did the treasure hunt go? I mean, where did he start hitting pay dirt in terms of finding out about the actual events of his great uncle's death? What happened to his possessions? When did he make a breakthrough?
So I think he first came to a full consciousness of it when he was about 10 years old. But, you know, up to as much as you can understand when you're 10.
Mm.
You know, and it's quite a dramatic scene where, you know, he asks his dad in the kitchen in their little humble home there with the linoleum floors. And
yeah, he said the wrong side of the tracks and everything.
Kind of the wrong side of the tracks. And, you know, and the water's, and it's raining, and the water's dripping into a bucket there from the leaky ceiling. And his dad's sitting there with a coffee and reading a book. His dad was a voracious reader. And he says to him, you know what, Dad, please just tell me what's up with these letters. And he says, I can't speak of those things. And, you know, he found scraps of papers in drawers talking about this Toulouse-Lautrec that he eventually was able to track down, which is a fascinating painting in its own right, because it's more complete. It looks more complete than the version that's hanging in Paris, because the version in Paris doesn't have the woman's head, and it doesn't have a piece of that double bass. So what was said to him, and from what he gathered from the fragments of documentation that he read, was that that was actually the original, and it was stolen from a bar, some kind of dive bar in Paris, because, you know, these things weren't worth much back in those days. And it was just poster art, you know, and nobody realized it's going to turn into this kind of icon of modern culture. So for him to have received that back, you know, it just arrived. It didn't arrive with all the other paintings that he received.
How did it just arrive? I don't understand.
It was just dropped at his door. You know, I mean, all
here
the,
in Johannesburg.
Yeah, I mean, all the other paintings there's quite a...
I mean, who gets a Toulouse-Lautrec dropped off at their door?
People who've done big favors for Mossad.
That's phenomenal.
It is an interesting story. And so I think we didn't get too caught up in whether or not these things are real. I mean, Carney's completely open to the possibility that they're all forgeries and that he's been led up the garden path.
Mm.
But the story is what it is.
I mean, the Chagall, the Gauguin looks amazing. It's
these paintings are lovely, yeah.
It looks like all his other work.
And, I mean, you can kind of, I've looked at all these paintings, and you can kind of lose yourself in them because they look so old. You know, they've got all the telltale signs of things that have been around for a really long time and that they've seen a lot of movement.
And does he just hang them up in his house?
He, he's got them. He's got some hanging up in the US. He's got some in Cape Town. He's got some up here. So
it's amazing.
It's quite extraordinary. He's got an original forgery by the Nazi himself, where the Nazi said to him, you know what, I'm an artist too. That's why I've looked after these paintings for such a long time.
Did he have much conversation with this guy, this Nazi?
They met three times. So
how did this Nazi just manage to elude the authorities, or how did it happen?
So they found him through his attempt to sell one of these paintings. And it was just the exact wrong painting to try to sell, because it's the painting that gave him away. You know, and I mean, if you read the book, it explains exactly how they knew. Because looking at it and looking at Carney, you know, wow, this is it. So that gave him away. And, you know, he was pretending to be, you know, ironically enough, Jewish, calling himself Herr Mandelbaum.
Yeah.
And that he was able to pass off his German accent for being a Swiss citizen. And obviously, you can't really elude Mossad forever. If they start looking for you in their sites, they're going to find you. And there's a lot in the book that looks into how these guys were actually helped to escape during and after the war, primarily through the Vatican, through being given papers by the Catholic Church to escape to
Chile,
places
Argentina,
like Argentina,
Namibia,
where they were warmly welcomed. And you know, these are things that were all documented very well, because one thing that the Germans.
The Germans
at the time,
were meticulous about their records.
I mean, even everybody they gassed and shot and so on in the Holocaust, they had records of. I mean, they contracted IBM to monitor these people, and those barcodes that you see on people's arms and necks, those are IBM codes.
So, they were the first Google.
And it's insane. And so, you know, because they were so OCD, you can track these people down, and that's pretty much what happened in this case. But if this guy hadn't popped out of the woodwork trying to sell this painting, then I don't think any.
So did he go to jail?
So he had a lot of intelligence information that was of interest to Mossad, mm-hmm. and also to, oddly enough, the KGB, which kind of comes out in the book as well. Talking about Project Paperclip, which was that American kind of, you could almost call it a scam, of kind of cleaning, expunging the records of some of the worst Nazis.
So that they could use them for their science.
So that they could use them for science.
At Los Alamos.
So because this guy had a lot of original documentation on that, I Carney believes that he traded on that.
He made a deal.
To kind of, you know, just basically
is
say...
Is he the guy who killed his great uncle?
We don't know that for a fact, but the fact is the guy did admit to having been in that house.
Wow.
He did have the artwork. But whether or not he pulled the trigger, who can say? He never, you know, he never said that. All he told Carney was, you know, I followed my orders. And of course, that there's a line in the book that says, so much of the worst of human history has been covered by those words. I just followed orders.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very reflective book. And
I think
for a South African audience, it's something that, you know, the publishers asked me, well, you know, who would want to read this? And I was like, well, who wouldn't? You know?
Well, there's a bit of history of Johannesburg in there. There's a bit of history of kind of the stage door, which was the place that he started. The art itself is almost that's the treasure at the end of the story. The adventure is finding it.
Yeah, and I think the fact that he's a maverick and the fact that I find him an inspirational guy. I mean, I don't really like motivational books per se. You know, I'm not going to go out there and buy the Yes, You Can.
No.
But to read a book like this has got that built into it to say, you know what, you can do crazy, amazing things if you really want to. You know, if you have the energy for it and you have the...
Why doesn't he
audacity?
Have someone appraise these and figure out if they're forgeries or not?
Look, he has.
And?
It's just very difficult without the paperwork. And, you know, he believes that the paperwork was withheld, you know, and or perhaps
this Nazi's dead now.
Yes, he died. Carney feels like he found out in a very strange way. Very, very strange way.
It's all so mysterious, right?
But he heard that the old guy died at a bus stop in the cold in Portugal on his own.
Wow. And he left nothing, no further instructions or information.
So it's, if you read the book, there's a lot of things I don't want to give away, but a lot revolves around what happened with this Nazi son.
Oh.
You know, and Carney plays a role later unwittingly, you know, in actually helping the son to get into South Africa, to perhaps start a new life here. We don't really know what the heck that was all about, but it's one of the strangest moments in the book.
So it even has questions about whether or not you would help your enemy's children, that sort of thing.
Well, it does ask
covering
that,
a lot of...
It does ask that question of, you know, if your father did despicable things, you know, does that reflect on you? And of course, Carney thinks it shouldn't. You know, so he's got nothing against the guy's son, because you can't let the sins of the father pass on.
It's quite a story. I mean, you must have had a lot of fun writing this.
You know, there's a lot of fun moments. A lot of it is just bum in seat, a lot of frustration trying to find out, you know, what's what, and trying to get the feeling of the story.
He didn't hold anything back from you, did he?
No. I think at first... You know, when you start writing a book with someone, I think the first thing you always try to do is establish trust and get that person to understand that you just want to tell the story right,
yeah.
and that they can trust you. And the moment that you get that done, and it's been an experience of note. I mean, 5 years later, you know, he and I are very close friends, and he's an enormously generous guy. And I think it would have been great to chat to him too.
Yeah. We'll tell him to come in here one day.
You know, he's in Cape Town, but...
next time he's up here, I'd love to talk to him.
Okay.
Sounds fascinating. So there it is. Nazi war booty, Degas dust. Carney Madison and Charles Lear. We're talking to Charles now about the book. It's fascinating. I love the fact that this is a real life story, but it almost feels like you're reading a novel.
I think, you know, he wanted to make a movie.
Yeah.
And he was talking to some big South African producers, I think maybe the odd person in America as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying to him that they do see a movie in it. They're just not sure which aspect of the story is the movie. But I see it as a bit of an Art Nouveau film. You know, you could perhaps try to turn it into an action kind of James Bondy type of thing, but that would be distorting what really happened there. You know, it's a very deep story about one man and some very, very strange things that happened to him. And that's why he wrote the original book as well, just for people to have that idea of the story. And so part of this book is now, you know, these people are going to read it now and decide, now we've got the whole story, and if we are going to do a screenplay, we've more or less got...
You could end up being the screenplay guy for a big Hollywood movie, Charles. This is very exciting. All right, well, listen, thank you for telling us this morning. It's a terrific book. Go and have a look at it. It's called Degas Dust, and it's available now, right?
Yeah, it's as far as I know, it's in all the good bookshops. It's about 280 Rand.
What you're basically saying is if it's not in that bookshop, it's
not a
good
bookshop. It's
right?
A pretty crap bookshop.
There we go. No, that's how we sell these things. I'm with you. But well done. Terrific, terrific stuff. When we come back in a moment, we're going to do a little bit of conspiracy theory with Flax, and then we've got to wrap it up for this morning, a very busy day on cliffcentral.com for the rest of it. Stick around. But big thank you to Charles Sayer for coming in to talk to us about this.
Thanks for having me.
And well done on the book. Cliffcentral.com.